Hello everyone and welcome along. It's good to have your company today. And today, well, I know it's just almost 2 weeks since it was Poetry Day with the Montana Poetry Day in New Zealand, but I thought it's time we heard from a poet. I'm afraid it's not a New Zealand poet today. It is actually an Australian poet. His name is Les Murray. Now, he's an award-winning poet from Australia and he's a bit of a household name over there. He's very, very popular and is read by lots of Australians. In fact, he received the Order of Australia. That's how much they love him in Australia. And he came over recently for the Auckland Writers and Readers Festival. He's a big man, and when I met him, he was dressed, you'd never pick that he was a poet or anything untoward at all. He had a bit of a holy jersey on and his shirt sticking out the top, and a very, very ordinary man, if I can put it like that, but a man who writes extraordinary poetry. In fact, he grew up on a dairy farm in a place called Bunya in New South Wales, and he went on to university and then he went into the Navy and then he retired from outside employment and made literature his full-time career. And to date he's published around about 30 books of poetry, and he is a highly respected man but a very loved man in Australia. So I thought we'd catch up for a little bit of a chat with the famous, in Australia, poet Les Murray. Les, I want you to tell us, first of all, how young you were when your love of words started turning into verse on the page.
I was 18.
Is that right? So it took you to 18?
It took me to 18. I came to it later than a lot of poets do. I knew I had a love of words, and on the other hand, in the 50s, boys were not interested in poetry.
No.
We were the soldiers of the Third World War, which never happened. And in the 60s, of course, that went away. It turned into Vietnam and went away. The fashion changed altogether, but we were too tough to write poetry or to take any notice of it.
So did you keep up that male facade then for the first 18 years of your life, that real men don't write poetry?
No, but I suppose it silenced teenage boys in those days, you know. And teenage girls were silenced by a strange kind of resentment at the time. I think it was because the pill hadn't been invented yet. And I don't know what quite was wrong with them. But no, we were in the aftermath of the Second World War, and we thought we were heading to the Third World War. But also, where I came from was very much folk culture. People went in for making their own fun, you know, dancing and music and gossip and lies and all that sort of thing.
Tell us a bit about where you grew up. You grew up on a dairy farm.
Mm. And there were no books there much. It was not a literate culture particularly. It was an oral culture. And my father, for example, was a very good ballroom dancer. But the arts that they respected were music and I suppose gossip and storytelling.
So how then, I mean, was there a moment when you were turned on to poetry? You said you were 18, so,
yeah.
So what was it that happened that changed you?
I saw a few examples of modern poetry. In school we were only taught English classics of several hundred years ago, Shakespeare and so on. Probably the most recent poetry we were shown in school on the official syllabus was Wordsworth. But when we saw some modern stuff, a few of us got interested. And when I saw some Australian modern poetry, I began thinking, I can do this. And I started to try it. I mean, the first modern Australian poets I saw were probably Judith Wright and Doug Stewart. Doug Stewart was born down here at Eltham and was really a New Zealander, but he went to Australia and had his career there. And I started trying to do it, and I was fascinated. I'd always been a word person, and about once a century in the Murray family you get one of these word freaks.
And you were
I was the one for the 20th century. Yeah, the one for the 19th century was James, my cousin, who wrote the Oxford English Dictionary.
Great, was that your connection to
that?
Well, there you go.
Before that, a century before that, there was a bloke who was herding cows and crawled in through the church window and started reading the books in the church. And he read all the books in English, then he taught himself Latin and read the books in Latin, and then he read the Greek ones, and he was halfway through teaching himself Hebrew when somebody discovered him. And he ended up, before he was out of his teens, he ended up as professor of classics at Edinburgh University.
Good grief. Yeah. So about every century one comes along.
Mm. It's a Murray word freak every century.
So at the age of 18, though, I mean, obviously you couldn't make a living out of being a poet. So what did you do?
But I was used to not making a living. I mean, I come from dairy farmers. They're all poor too.
Yeah, that's right.
And being in poetry is much the same as being in dairying, because you pick up your income from this, that and the other. You know, you put it all together and patch it together and make a living. Partly subsidies and partly doing a bit of work on the road and in the forest and that sort of thing. It's very much the same in literature.
So you were in the Navy for a while, weren't you? Or the Marine Reserve, or was
not
that...
Not really. I was in the Navy Reserve playing around, you know. I ended up a sea cook on a ship.
Whereabouts did you go?
Nowhere much. Just up and down the coast.
And were you a bit reasonable cook?
I wasn't a bad slushy. I wasn't a really great cook, but as a slushy, I wasn't bad. A slushy is one who smokes while he's cooking. You know?
Not too much ash got on the mashed potatoes, I hope, Liz.
They wouldn't have noticed.
Probably just thought it was pepper.
nobody ever threw the food at me.
Well, there you go. It couldn't have been too bad at all. But I read that you actually basically pulled out of outside employment at, were you about 31, 33?
Somewhere about that, it was the year 1971. I pulled the, I jumped out of the employment aeroplane. You know, I haven't hit the ground yet.
No. So, what made you decide though that you wanted to stop doing all the everyday work and concentrate on your writing? You'd obviously had some success by then.
I wasn't bad at everyday work, but I didn't like going there much. You know, having to travel to it, it seemed to be artificial, because where I grew up on the farm, you didn't go to work. Work was all around you. You walked out the door, and if you're a woman, you didn't even walk out the door because it was inside.
Yes, that's right.
It came in after you. But I came back from overseas and went back into the public service. Worked for the Prime Minister's Department, then went back to Sydney. And there wasn't much Commonwealth Public Service in Sydney, and it was kind of dead-end jobs. And I sat around in one for about 3 months, and I said to the boss, I'm going home. And he said, what, are you ill? And I said, no. I said, I'm going to go home and practice my true occupation. And he was quite worried about me. He used to ring up occasionally and say, are you surviving? You all right? You want to come back? Nope, don't want to come back.
Yeah. So you went home, and you went back to where you'd grown up?
No, just home. We lived in Chatswood in Sydney.
Oh, okay, right.
We had lived in Canberra. And then...
So you went home to write?
Hmm. And partly because my wife had a job as a teacher and was well paid, and I just thought, somehow it can be made to work, and it has so far been made to work. And they wouldn't have me back in the public service now.
And I mean, it has worked, because you're a prolific writer and written quite a number of books, both poetry and prose, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've won many awards as well.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I just like to do it well if I can, and find out fresh ways of doing things.
How would you describe, because there'll be a lot of people listening today who've never heard of you before,
yeah,
so don't know much about your poetry or your style, so how would you describe to people Les Murray the poet?
Be very hard, because I try to do everything. I try to work right across the field and do all sorts of poems, so there's no one poem that sums me up, you know.
You do short ones, long ones?
Short ones, long ones, working things out. Often you do things several times over, because they raise more subject matter, and you then come back to it and do more on that subject, you know.
And you've written like one, I've got Freddie Neptune there, which is really one long poem, yeah, book of a
that
poem.
That was almost like discovering another personality in myself, you know, another person, another me.
Yeah.
I was nearly called Fred. But they gave me this silly name of Leslie instead, because Mum and Dad both had brothers called Leslie. And somehow Fred always stayed with me, and he became a German-Australian who had many adventures in the early part, well, the first half of the 20th century. And he more or less stood up in front of my mind and said, I'm Fred Bircher. I'm a German-Australian who saw something absolutely unbearable in 1915 in Turkey and lost my sense of touch. And tell my story. I had to discover his story. Mm-hmm. And it was like being in a trance. You went into that story and you found your way along, and occasionally you'd slip off the thread of the story, and you'd know it's gone dead, it's gone false. Mm-hmm. Go back a couple of stanzas and see what's gone wrong. Yep, that's where we lost it. go from there.
How long did it
take? 5 years I was working.
5 years. Were you doing other writing work during that time as well?
Yeah, Fred would occupy me for about 4 or 5 months, and then I'd step off Fred and leave him for 6 or 8 months. Mm. And build up another head of steam, you know. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of book four, it's in five books, in the middle of book four I came down with an abscess on the liver.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, because this would be what year? Is this where you...
96.
Now, yeah. This was a bit of a turning point in your life because you went into a coma, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us what happened.
Well, I didn't know it, but I had a bad gallbladder which had holes in it, and some E. coli got out of there and went and started eating the best piece of offal it could find, which was my liver. And I got very, very sick and went into hospital, and they took a while to diagnose what was wrong. It's not absolutely uncommon, it does happen, but they just didn't know it. So I was about a week getting really sick, and I got delivered to a better hospital about half an hour before I was going to die. And it was kind of interesting, you know. I was rapidly sinking into death, and had a rehearsal, you know. And the last thing I heard the surgeon say was, "We may well not save this one."
Great.
And then I woke up half an hour later, and I said to my wife, "How's the Olympics going?" And she said, "The Olympics are over."
So you'd been out of
it for 3 weeks. Yeah.
Oh, good grief. And, she must have been very worried about you.
Yeah, she sat there beside the bed, day in and day out, you know. And they had all these instruments, various tubes and stuff going into me. I was wired for sound and light and everything else. And once apparently I fell out of bed with all my tubes in, but they picked me up again. And
it actually provided the basis for another of your books. The title of the tell us about that.
I don't. Well, they in the newspaper just after I woke up, they said Poet Les Murray is now conscious and verbal. And that's part of what they call the Glasgow Protocols. It's a sort of a set of descriptions of people in coma. And conscious and verbal is the one you want to be. You know, that's the one where you've survived and you're coming out of it. And I was talking and fully conscious. I was still fairly helpless. I couldn't walk. I'd try to get out of bed and I'd fall about like a sick duck, and I never did recover all of my sense of balance. I still wobble a bit, you know, particularly in the dark. I look like a drunk when I walk in the dark. And but that was the only long-term deficit I got out of it. And
did it change the way you looked at your own life, or you looked at life in general, having come so close to death?
Yeah, it does.
How? Tell me how.
You feel that you're in the afterlife. You know, it's not the same as when you went in. You never come back from there the same as you went in. It also got rid of most of my depression. I'd had bad depressive illness, and suddenly I thought it was absolutely gone. It never completely leaves you, but it only left a ghost of itself. Mm. And I thought, oh, this is good. I'm going to be able to find out what happened to Freddie Neptune. So I wrote the last book and a half of him, and found out. I didn't know until the last page what was going to happen.
And we better not say, because we'll have to find out for ourselves, won't we?
I should read the book. Yeah.
So now you're a few years down the road from that event.
Yeah.
How would you describe Les Murray? Very much a changed man in terms of the way you approach life, or the same?
Not especially, but I've had me rehearsal. One day I'll have one that is not the rehearsal. It'll be the real thing. But at least I've been there, and I know I can do it. Mm. You have to achieve death. You have to work at it. You have to do it. It's automatic, but you have to you agree to something. Mm-hmm. And if you agree to something, you never can quite take back the agreement. You have consented to something.
Yes.
You know. Yeah. I remember my father when he was dying. He said, "Oh, you're busting to talk, but I'm too busy dying."
Yeah. Quite a great line, really, isn't it?
Yeah, great line. I said, "You mean it's hard work?" He said, "Yeah, bloody hard work."
Yeah, and it is too. So, where do you live now? Do you you gone back to where your roots were?
Yeah, I went back there in 19. I went back the last day of 85, and my wife came up a couple of days later. And
do you live anywhere near where the dairy farm was that you grew up on?
About a mile down the creek.
Is it important for you to be back there?
Yeah, I like it. And we said to ourselves, Valerie said, "Well." Of course, she didn't come from there. She came from Budapest and grew up in Switzerland and came to Australia when she was 10. And she said, "Well, I'll give it a year's trial and see how I like it, you know, see if I can live there." And, of course, you know, the family wasn't just me. You know, we had to be sure the family liked it. and two of them were already more or less getting towards being independent by that stage. We went up there, and after a month, Valerie said, "Well, the year's trial's over. I love it."
And you've been there ever since?
I said, "Why do you love it?" And she said, "Well, I see more of my fellow women up here than I ever saw in Sydney. A greater variety of them. Because down in Sydney, she only saw fellow teachers." Yeah. And suddenly she was dealing with women who were on farms and all sorts of folks, you know. It was more socially diverse than the city had been.
And you love it, she loves it, so that makes for a nice settled...
We say to each other now, "No, we wouldn't go and live anywhere else. We're here now." Yeah. We used to dream things like, "Oh, will we go and live in England for a year, or will we go and live in such and such?" Never say it anymore. We say, "Oh, no, we're here now."
You love it. Well, you better read us a poem, so we've got a little bit of a feel about what... And I know that this is not indicative of you, because you write short ones, long ones, whole books of one topic. Yeah. But you've got something to share with us today, Les.
Sure. It's called The Moon Man. It's a true story. Shadowy kangaroos moved off as we drove into the top paddock, coming home from a wedding under a midnightish curd sky. Then his full face cleared. Moon Man, the first birth ever, who still massages his mother and sends her light, for his having been born fully grown. His brilliance is in our blood. Had Earth fully healed from that labour, no small births could have happened.
Lovely. Well done. And thank you for joining us today, and enjoy the rest of your stay here in New Zealand.
I always do.
Cheers, Les. Thank you.
Cheers.